Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of the 2026 draft review, where we go through all 11 players drafted by the Ravens. We got through their day one and day two picks, as well as some trends in the first episode. Ravens, trend-wise, had some sweating to wait and get Vengiwane in the first round, had size and power be a primary thing they drafted for. They made all their picks, including one trade up using 2027 draft capital. They had a rather surprising double dip in wide receivers that we're going to get into the second part of with our first player we discussed in the second one. They did not solve their center situation. I think we're still waiting to find out how that's going to be resolved. What else? They were significantly concerned with age as they went through it. We heard a lot about how a lot of the guys on the board were older, but their early players picked were younger guys. And I think that continues to make sense for a lot of reasons. We'll jump in right now and talk about the fourth player they drafted, who was in round four, Elijah Surratt of Indiana, who played a storied movement in his career, but he'll be 23 in May and was the oldest player in the top four that the Ravens drafted. It's got him at number 115, an ex-receiver. He's delivered outstanding results at Indiana despite limited length and limited athleticism, including a 4.60 40, 31 and a quarter inch arms. He is 6'2", 210. 9.5 yards per target last year, 2.39 yards per route run. They depended on him pretty much as a big component of the Indiana offense with one target every 4.0 pass snaps. So that's a big deal. Did it with a pretty high ADOT of 9.6. It wasn't a lot of underneath throws. There were some, but 34.5% contested catches is one of the big concerns with Surratt. It was also a big concern for Lane in round three. So that's something to be looked forward to. Quarterback rating, though, throwing to him is 132.9. So that tells you a lot of what you need to do. He's a good box out player, does some things well to make plays on the football, and definitely something you would need to have given that very, very high contested catch rate. His contested catch rate was in the fourth percentile, meaning it was the 10th most of 270 wide receivers with 50 plus targets. That's really bad. And the production when contested has dropped throughout his college career. And I did want to bring that up here. Let me just take a moment. All right. Yeah, I wanted to have that in front of me when I looked at it here. But yeah, his contested catch percentage for career is 57.4%, which is not terrible, but it was 61.1%. In his first year at St. Francis of Pennsylvania, moved on to James Madison, where he caught 79% of his contested catch balls in a great season, 15 out of 19, then 59.3% in Indiana and 40% in his final year at Indiana, despite having a great year. So not the trajectory you'd like with the contested catch success either. And he does face the prospect of even more contested catches at the NFL level. He can beat press coverage with strength, but that's going to be more difficult with yet another move up in class for him. That's been one of the stories of his career, is he's had all these successive moves up in class where he's overcome that at every level. So he went from an FCS freshman All-American at St. Francis of Pennsylvania to a first-team All-Sun Belt as a sophomore. And as much as we want to be snobs, that was James Madison. And then we need to be snobs a little bit with regard to context. He went to third team Big Ten as a junior in the Big Ten. And then second team All Big Ten as a senior. So each year, it's been a little bit more in terms of expectations and frankly, in terms of success, in terms of what he's done. He's had different quarterbacks each year. And that's something he's been able to beat anyway. Is really, you see who Elijah Surratt is at the catch point. His very strong hands. He has extreme fearlessness in terms of going up for the ball. If you remember Clarence Moore a few years back, he's the antithesis of that. A guy who might alligator arm a ball. When he went up for it, missed a key third down throw in that game against the Jets at the Meadowlands in 2004. I still haven't forgiven him for it. He did catch two touchdowns in that game, by the way, on zipper. a play that Maureen still calls anytime the Ravens are inside the 10-yard line is I want to see Zipper. Anyway, did a fine job in terms of that. Good box out player, kind of like a power forward looking for the rebound, does a good job with that. Very effective back shoulder receiver. And he's had good timing with four different quarterbacks in 4 years. That will kind of a good indication for you of where the importance of the quality between receiver and quarterback goes. I think it is more a function of the wide receiver. Now, both guys have to be in place on their timing, but if you have a wide receiver who's even a little bit inconsistent, you'd see, you know, widely varying results in that. And that just hasn't been the case with Surratt, and he's been very good with different quarterbacks. So I take that as a very positive indication in terms of his play. He really can't win battles stride for stride. That's certainly going to be true at the next level. So he's not a guy who is a, you know, even a slow acceleration guy who beats you down the field. He's got to beat you with something he's selling at the top of the stem. And he does have a little bit of that. So positive characteristics that he does not have the same, I did not think, despite being he's basically the same size as Lane, or Lane is 6'4", 200, and Surratt is 6'2", 210. So Surratt's even a little bigger weight-wise, but he's shorter. I didn't see the same kind of hip drop at the top of the stem that would create the lack of separation that you might, you know, be fearful of. So he's got a little more to sell, and it's a good thing because he's less fast, obviously, than Lane is. So, each of them brings interesting and somewhat different characteristics to the field. It'll be very interesting to see how they split their time. The Ravens have, you know, now four tight ends on the roster again. They have, looks like six wide receivers on the roster again, and they're going to have a lot of trouble dividing up targets again. And we all know that targets are in short supply when it comes to Lamar Jackson. In fact, the Ravens threw the ball 200 fewer times than their opponents in 2025 for a combination of reasons. One is they snapped the ball a lot less, but the other is they just like to run the football and like to dominate teams that way as opposed to throwing it. So when the all balls go through Lamar Jackson and some of them go to him, you know, there's less touches for everybody else, and receivers just have to be understanding about that. Zay Flowers is the one guy, who's got a really decent number of targets and made use of them. In terms of other elements of the game, Surratt's a decent run blocker. I think he'll be fine managing level three defenders, you know, putting his shoulder and arms into occasionally an inside linebacker. He's not a guy you'd want really making a chip block on the inside. He's a bigger wide receiver, but he's not a Miles Boykin type guy who I'd put in that role. There's had some other tough wide receivers here over the last few years who maybe were happier in that role. Surratt's more of a elfin build is probably the wrong word, but he's more of a slender build, even at 6'2", 210. What else to say? Entire college career, he moved up in class effectively. I've already talked about that a little bit. I think he's less of a sure thing than the other below the line athletes in the wide receiver class this year. But he's had a drumbeat like success that I think is worth a gamble. There are people who are going to tell you he had Fernando Mendoza this last year at Indiana. Yeah, that's true. But he had a whole bunch of other guys that weren't Fernando Mendoza prior. And he at every level, he's managed to succeed. So I said I liked him at number 80. That was a narrow consensus band for 10 services. DaCosta said he was by far the best player when he's left at 115 on the board. And this is really interesting because this is kind of like Starks and Green last year. I would have loved the two players drafted in the opposite order. Now, two wrong or one wrong doesn't overcome a double right. If they should have had somebody else at number 80, but I do like the combination of those two picks. I think they got in aggregate, I think they got value for Lane and Surratt. What else to say? One concern I would have is that he doesn't really have the same value to the Ravens because they have kind of an absence of back shoulder throws in their offense. You don't see very many from Lamar at all. But he could still do some of the things that I think Lane will also do, in terms of being an outside the numbers guy who will go up and fight for the football. And that's something that has gone well throughout his career. I intended to have that number for you. It's been four interceptions thrown to him in his college career, and he's had 44 touchdowns, 44-4. That's even better than Lamar Jackson's ratio of touchdowns to interceptions in that marvelous 2024 season where he was cheated out of the MVP. The passer rating throwing to Surratt career, 141.9. He wasn't penalized at all in his final year, and he was penalized only four times in his career. So there's a hell of a player there. And the results, just outstrip any projection of his athleticism and size and whatnot that you might put upon him. Just a very heady receiver and very, very careful going up for the ball, very aggressive going up for the ball, I should say. Let's move on to the next pick, which is Matthew Hibner at number 133. The Ravens moved up to make that selection, and a surprising selection in a lot of ways. They traded a fifth and a sixth to move up to 133, which is at the end, near the end of the fourth round. I didn't have him on my board at all among the tight ends. Tight end class is extremely deep, but Hibner played 3 years at Michigan, during which time he had all of two targets, and then two more at SMU, where he had a much more significant target total, but still was not a central part of the SMU offense in those last 2 years. So, and we'll get to some of the stats on that in a second. 6'4", 251, 457, 32 3/8-inch arms, and he'll be 24 in March. So he's the first player taking round four here who really isn't a typical Ravens age pick. So a guy, unfortunately, like Hayden Hurst, who was 24 when drafted, the Ravens have to live with that in terms of how long he's going to be around. Very good vertical, 161, 10 yard, 28 bench reps, unusual for a tight end to be that high, to be certain. Receiving metrics in 2025 were outstanding, 10.1 yards per target. He's 10.2 career. So it's basically all his receiving, all of his targets came at SMU effectively. His yak per reception was 6.8 in 25. I think that was a fluke. It's 7.6 career. So he's even better the year before. Eight out of 8.8, the same both years. Passer rating throwing to him, only 96.7 this year and 106.2 career. Now here's the troubling thing. Missed tackles force per reception is only 0.03 this last year and 0.09 career, despite those outstanding yak numbers. So a couple of things came to mind. Was it a lot of short passes where he got some easy yak, or more importantly, might have gotten some red yards, meaning yak that was just getting him from minus whatever at the catch point to zero? And that really wasn't the case. He actually lived on the seam route. If you look just at his highlights, I mean, it's pretty much all seam routes off play action. And there are a couple extended plays in there. Don't get me wrong. It's not all that, but there were a couple seam routes where he went down. That's a lot of the big plays that he had in his college career. He is a pure flex player. Only 22.6% of his college snaps came in line. Sadiq was very heavily criticized for that, but he had 27.6% in line, almost 20% more inline play, actually more than 20% more inline play than Hibner had. So, he'll be an Isaiah Likely type replacement or an Andrews replacement, if you want to consider, but Andrews plays in line more than he does. Surprisingly, and this is kind of paradoxically almost, he did grade very well on 156 college pass blocking snaps. I don't have anything else to go on. I didn't look at a bunch of highlights of him to actually look at his individual pass blocking, and it's spread out with four and six snaps per game and whatnot. But that's a good sign if he's asked to play in line or chip some, that he has some history of success with that. He's not a dangerous tackle breaker, as I indicated from the levels. He had only one play over 30 yards going into his final four college games. That was an 80-yard play he'd had in the 2024 season. But in each of his final four college games, he had one play of over 30 yards, and that included an 80-yard play versus Arizona in the bowl game last year. I didn't look up what bowl that was, but it's really good to have your play your best play be your last play. As always, the most recent play is the most pertinent. And, I'm happy to see that. It's also probably against better opponents. He had very good extended play chemistry from what I saw with Jennings at SMU. Jennings is a mobile quarterback. They did a lot of play action stuff, and he's certainly very effective in the seam. There was some mesh point work. There was just some standard play action too. A lot of his big plays came just running right by somebody down the seam, oftentimes a linebacker, catching the ball in stride and going a long way. And that was Jennings sold a lot of those plays very well for him. I think he could be, and he had other plays where he's an extended play target also, I should say, where Jennings was running around the pocket and, you know, you're thinking this guy looks a little bit like Lamar Jackson, and he would get the ball to Hibner in the end zone or very late on the play for a big play. I mentioned he already picked up a lot of his yak on those seam routes I talked about before. He does find space, I think, well, and present himself well in zone. I think that's something that the Ravens will try and exploit, is that you get Lamar Jackson, you get a lot of opposing zone defense. I think that's probably been exactly the case at SMU, just watching a little bit of Jennings that I have, is that other teams would be very afraid to not play zone against a mobile threat like that. And he made some plays. He had about 20% contested catches with just average success. I don't think there's anything really to look at there. He's smallish to move into a bigger inline role with the Ravens. I think the Ravens have to consider how they do that, you know, whether or not he can be Isaiah Likely and do some chipping. Maybe that's what he'd be limited to. He's quick enough that you could use him primarily as a slot. He kind of continues a trend that the Ravens aren't looking for slot receivers. They have flex tight ends. So you got a guy out there who's a 457 guy. He's got good size. He's got good zone characteristics. He's very good with play action. I think that's a guy that is basically going to continue what's happened through all the Lamar Jackson era to date. And I think we based on the two tight end drafts, even with the two wide receiver drafts ahead of them, I don't think there's going to be a massive shift to 11 personnel that people are expecting. It's probably a little more 11 and a little more 12 to make up for a reduction in 21 and 22 is what I would guess. We'll see. I just went through a 2 to 3 minute discussion of this with folks on the draft stream. And one of the things I have to say is I don't think we really know what either Minter or Doyle is going to bring to the individual schemes yet. And so we are making some judgments, making some educated guesses. Minter, it's probably more sure that he'll play the most important piece, which is Kyle Hamilton on the defense at slot corner. If he does that, since he's done it with Derwin James already, run that defense kind of similarly, then we can probably make better guesses, better, more informed choices. Hopefully there'll be success and rotation and differences at the snap package wise. I expect it to be pretty similar to what the Ravens put on the field in 2025, that Hamilton will move to dime. He'll play slot corner. And they'll pretty much have reduced outside cornerback needs. I certainly hope that's the case, given the lack of depth that the Ravens have on the outside. But I expect that they'll do quite a bit of the same things they did, hopefully just better than they did in the Orr era. So the pass rush will probably have a little bit more to it in terms of deceptiveness, in terms of rotation of coverages, that they probably will do more. Anyway, we'll see exactly what Minter tries to do. On the other side of the ball, the Doyle side, I have much less of an idea. Everybody wants to peg him into one particular guy's never played called plays before. You know, what Ben Johnson did, I don't think that's necessarily what he does. He's a Peyton disciple. So, you know, who knows exactly how Doyle will run the offense. And that's where, you have to take the little cues. The Ravens don't apparently have a fullback at this point. They have a couple of tight ends who might line up there, and they have probably then a significant move to 11, 12, 13 being packages they use when you use the position on the scorebook and from the scorebook or from the roster. I think it's many tight ends lined up in different ways that will give the opposing defensive coordinators still hopefully matchup nightmares. Ricard did less of that. You know, you knew where Ricard was going to be a fair amount of the time. He could be in line or he could be in the backfield, but he wasn't going to be a receiving threat. And so you at least could take that off the table and set your personnel opposed to it a certain way. Whereas with the tight ends they now have, they all got a little bit of receiving ability at a minimum. Smythe is, you know, has got the least of the little bit probably of the group. And you know, I would expect, you know, all of them are intended to be legitimate receiving threats when they show them to the opposing defensive coordinator who then gets to put in their personnel second. So, it'll be interesting to see how that works out. All right, let's move on. Chandler Rivers, the next pick, and they picked him in round five, pick 162. 5'10", 185, 440, 29 and 3/8 inch arms. That's the big thing. 23 in October, so he's not yet, he's still 22 now. Outstanding jumps. His 10 yard is just okay. His 2025 coverage metrics were not good. His coverage snaps per target were okay at 1 every 7.9, but yards per target of 7.8 is below the line for a draftable corner, certainly. A good amount of yak per reception to 5.3. Missed tackle rate was okay at 11.8%. Has not been okay for his career. 84.9% opposition passer rating is higher than you would expect. Did have a decent coverage snaps per penalty rate of 241 this last year. I think it was 2 and 482, if I recall correctly. He played 52 games at Duke in 4 years, and he started all but the first 7 during his freshman All-American season, so he's been durable and healthy. Buddy is a small outside cornerback with short arms. I see him as moving to slot in the NFL, except he's joined the Baltimore Ravens, and now the only slot job that's available is slot in dime situations. Keon Martin is his competition there, so you know he's got somebody to beat out for starters. Rivers is a draft pick and a fifth round pick. Martin was undrafted, but he played pretty decently last year, and I would think that the you know, that's a pretty even battle coming into camp. I think certainly not one that Rivers has won. So it's something that, you know, if he's going to get that slot role, let's put it a different way. I think he has to win that slot role versus Keon Martin to have a hope of winning outside time as well. I mean, I think that's where it is. And as the season rolls on, there are probably injuries at cornerback. There may be opportunities that come up for him that will emerge as an outside cornerback. I'm not sure he gets that chance over, say, a TJ Tampa, unless he can win that slot role away from Keon Martin. So I wouldn't say on the fringe of the roster. I don't think there's a big chance that he gets cut. I just think that there's not an obvious what his role is in this first year. Now, I did the cornerback show with Derek Coleman of All-22 Films. I highly respect him, highly recommend his channel, by the way. But Rivers is somebody that he really liked a lot more than I did. I liked Rivers, but I had him farther down my board, largely because of the slot corner position. I think he's the only one that makes sense for him in the NFL. And I also had that for D'Angelo Pons, who's an outstanding cornerback. I mean, he significantly north of Rivers, was drafted earlier, et cetera, et cetera. But is a guy who's strictly a slot corner. And I had him as 15th on my board because of that, because he didn't really fit with the Ravens. And I have a Ravens centric board in terms of how I order them. So Rivers is an interesting pick for the Ravens. I didn't expect it. I didn't expect it to be in round five. They did take a corner. He was one of the best corners remaining on the board, no doubt about that, when they got him. He's certainly got his limitations. What else do I have to say? He's only had 4 flags in the last 3 seasons. And that's while he's gotten 174 targets. That's outstanding discipline, very difficult for corners. So that's a positive. His ball skills have been good, but not outstanding considering that target volume. So one thing I look at is I look at the interceptions plus the passes defense, which are 36 total, 7 interceptions and 29 passes defense. But that's come in 231 career targets. So that's about 36 over 230 be about 16%. As a rate, and the good cornerbacks are even a little bit north of 20. So his is a little bit south of what I would call the top end of the draftable cornerbacks anyway. So anyway, not terrible ball skills by any stretch. But if you're listening to people who really overpraise his ball skills, I'd say they're solid, but they're not great. And they're not great, certainly, in the draftable cornerback sense. He got beat for some big plays in 2025. I looked at the biggest plays he got beaten for. The long was a 56-yard play by Virginia's Chandler Morris to Trell Harris down the left sideline, which set up a field goal in Virginia's 34-17 win. That actually put that Duke ACC championship in peril. They came back, they won the game, but Duke won their first ACC championship since 1962, which was a very big deal for them. And that was the big play that almost cost them the championship. That said, he's the unquestioned leader of the Duke secondary. In a lot of ways, it would have made more sense for him to play nickel just because of the position would lead to additional communication, additional opportunity to align players differently. But he's their leader, no doubt about it. I think the biggest question for him is whether his outstanding leaping display that we saw at the combine compensate for his size. I don't know if I mentioned that, but he did have outstanding jumps at the combine. He's a nickel slot corner only with the Ravens, with Hamilton moving to with Hamilton moving to weak side linebacker. And I guess it's possible if he wins that job that he's the fourth or fifth cornerback and can find some playing time with injuries on the outside. Things could change. Things evolve over time. The Ravens have had a couple smaller cornerbacks go in on the outside with some success. Lardarius Webb, certainly a guy who didn't have prototypical outside size, but still ended up being big enough to play that position and be a combo slot slash outside guy. I think the length is the bigger issue for Rivers in terms of him being a successful guy on the outside. So I'm probably a little bit lukewarm on the pick where they got him there. We move on. Josh Cuevas out of Alabama is the round six, pick 173. He'll be 23 in September also, so still 22 right now, but he's got five college seasons in the books, two at Cal Poly, one at Washington, and then two at Alabama. The two at Cal Poly were in FCS years. With the exception of his 40 time, which was 4.65, he's got 30 and 5/8-inch arms, and all his testing is meh, as I would put it. As I did put it here in my notes, with a bad three cone of 737. So he's not a guy that is an exceptional athlete. His receiving metrics show as not an exceptional athlete. 8.2 yards per target this last year. It does have a fair amount of yak and a really, really low ADOT. So a lot of the throws to him were short throws, behind the line of scrimmage throws, where he had to make things happen after the catch. And in fact, it's more extreme in previous years. No, I'm sorry, that's not true. He had an 8.1 career ADOT. The passer rating throwing to him is about 116.3, and it's 108.5 for his career. He has a decent missed tackle forced rate, not great for a tight end at 0.19. There's certainly a number of guys in this class who had better missed tackle forced rates at the tight end position, but it's better than Hibner, for example, by a significant amount. He breaks more than twice as many tackles, or has broken more than twice as many tackles in his career as Hibner has on a rate basis. In 5 years, he had a total of 170 targets, with over half of those coming at Cal Poly in 2022 specifically. So his number of FBS targets is limited, and it is one of the questions that comes with him. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.com. For some, summer is their favorite season. Travel picks up, kids are out of school, and adventure is the focus. For others, juggling it all can be tough, can make you feel overwhelmed, and can make you count down the minutes until the kids are back in school. I know I look forward to summer as a time to take a break, but as a self-employed person, time spent away from my work is time I stress over wasting. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp is a quality therapist who work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S., BetterHelp does the initial therapist matching for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12 plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right on the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session, based on 1.7 million client reviews. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. find support and therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. I suspect he'll be more of an inline guy. He did play 54% of his snaps inline in 2025. That was his highest in five seasons, but I'm looking at the rest of the Ravens roster, and I don't think it's going to be Andrews or Hibner playing inside. That would be, you know, a much bigger shift. So it makes sense that Cuevas will be a guy. He may line up in the backfield some. He may line up in line a fair amount. And I would, if I had to put an over-under on 54%, I'd go for the over on 54% in line. He is dangerous after the catch, but with the many shorter routes at Alabama, there are a fair amount of red yards in that yak total. That said, he can run right through people, and has done so. He had a long play of 32 yards in 2025, but he had several longer ones in the past. And he is one of the more dangerous tight ends after the catch in this draft, both in terms of his ability to pick him up and put him down in terms of the speed, but also in terms of the ability to run through some tackles. If you look at how he caught the ball this last year, it was a lot of flat and screen routes and other plays behind the line of scrimmage. What else is there to say? Does find space well in zone. That's something, if you don't do that as a tight end, it almost disqualifies you from being drafted anyway, or should. So the guys who present well in zone, generally, I think are good matches for Lamar Jackson. You know, there's a lot of space created between L2 and L3, and he's one of many guys in this tight end class who can find that for you. And certainly Hibner is in that group as well. He has no real history of contested catches, and a lot of that is route based, and you know, the relatively low number of targets he's had. He was on the Mackey Award watch list this last season. So to sum things up, I think he's certain to get time in line. He will need to make himself valuable, knocking down guys or walling off guys in space in level two and three. So the Ravens' run game depends highly on their tight ends keeping their feet and making good positional blocks versus those smaller men in L2 and L3. I think he's a guy who can do that, and so we'll see if that works out. And I think that the other thing I'd point to is the ability to beat zones. There were other guys on the board who just had all kinds of warts on them. Daquan Wright, I had ranked higher. Michael Trigg, I had ranked higher. Obviously, the Ravens did not like those. And not only that, the rest of the league seemed to hate those guys in terms of what was going on. So they probably interviewed very poorly. They're both the spectacular athletes, and Trigg is, you know, about the most acrobatic player with an enormous catch radius and ability to break tackles that's remarkable. But no one took him. And so the reasons must be significant for someone to pass up on the tape that's out there for him through seven rounds of the NFL draft. It's just it boggles the mind. I will say our panelists for days two and three both were, including Michael Trigg, for most of the Ravens' last nine selections. He was on people's top five list, even for the Zion Young selection. And he was certainly every pick after that he was listed. Now, we realized that the well had to be poisoned at some point, but he was on the list as we went down. Okay, move down to the next pick, and that's Adam Randall from Clemson, the running back. They took in round five, pick 174. So they actually had a double whammy of picks here between 173 and 174. Interesting thing came up is that we think that all the Ravens needed to do was turn in both picks by the end of the 174 time limit, because you can make your pick anytime afterwards. You just have to make sure that the pick is in by your deadline. Or somebody else might pick ahead of you. So, but since the Ravens were the next team picking, there wasn't any risk of that. And so 173 and 174 is an interesting double there. And it does not really matter that they took Cuevas with the first and Randall with the second, but Adam Randall from Clemson as a running back. Now, this one of the interesting things about that is DaCosta reported that Steve Bisciotti had done a lot of scouting on this topic, and it was his pick. We have never in 25 years plus of Steve Bisciotti being around this organization heard of him making a pick. I don't think it's a good development. I'd rather I'd rather heard that our scouts are very high on Adam Randall. They loved his size. They loved the significance. They loved how much he looked like Gus Edwards. They love blah, 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 blah about him. And by the way, another thing that put him over the top was that Steve Bisciotti went out and had dinner with him, really liked him. And the scouts showed Bisciotti his film after that dinner. And that really turned him on too. So he was the one, if it was something like that, where the instigation was from the scouting originally, and then Bisciotti had made had helped make the selection, I'd be fine with that. The notion they did it is something I've heard the syntax from DaCosta before. And the player is Devon Drew. You've heard the story probably before if you've been listening to the show for a while, but he was being asked about it might have been the 2010 draft or thereabouts that Devon Drew was taken. He was asked about that draft to go through every player on the list. And he got down to Devon Drew. He says, well, that was Ozzie's pick. The least like commitment to a pick you'll ever hear from Eric DaCosta. So it almost is saying, I got overruled. I didn't like the guy Eric picked. Ozzie picked Devon Drew. So not what you, certainly want to hear. Anyway, let's talk about Adam Randall a little bit. He's a converted running back from wide receiver in his final college season. That's very unusual. He was a pure outside guy as a wide receiver too. I thought, well, at that size, he's 6'3", 232, runs a 4.50, 40, 32 3/8. I mean, it almost sounds like a flex tight end, a guy you'd see playing in the slot a lot because you'd want him to bully a safety who might try to be too big for that, and he'd be too fast for a linebacker maybe at 4.50, and you'd think you'd have that combination. Pure outside guy. And his testing was outstanding across the board. He did everything at the combine. The only thing he didn't do well was a 4.53 shuttle. Everything else was well above the line. And that's certainly a positive in terms of the athleticism. His receiving metrics were, to say the least, unspectacular prior to 2025. At wide receiver, he had a yards per target of 6.0 through his 3 years at the position, 2.6 yak per reception, a passer rating of 76 throwing to him. Did have a good missed tackles force rate of 0.27, which was very good for a wide receiver. But he needed a position change, and he got it. He is, as a result, extremely low tread wear, despite having 158 carries, which is a significant amount, in his final college season with Clemson. So that's a positive. And a lot of running backs come into the league with 600 or 700 or 800 carries under their belt, and you worry about how long they're going to last. I don't think that is the first concern with Adam Randall. Had 10 touchdowns and 2 fumbles in his senior year. A missed tackle force rate is a little lower than I would have expected, actually, at 0.18. I think he can improve that. Eddie Faulkner, as a running backs coach, is known for improving missed tackle force rates. And the other thing that should help that, well, reason number one is Lamar Jackson getting more level 2 opportunities. Reason number two is Ledford scheming up more first contact and level 2 opportunities. This guy, when you watch him on tape, he leans right into contact and tries to run right through it. Effectively, he's always making a half man move. He likes to make half man contact on a smaller defender and blast through it. There's very few people that can really stand up to it. In fact, he kind of looks like Derrick Henry running around the football field against some of these smaller L2 and L3 defenders. And it's very nice. He also has an oddly large running back with a vertical build. So you think about Cordarrelle Patterson, being a converted wide receiver also, by the way, who went to running back and had, then a very powerful but tall build. Interesting player. I think he is certain to make the team based on who the Ravens have at running back, not just the fact that Bisciotti is chose him. Gus Edwards might be a reasonable comp. Gus Edwards is more compact at the same weight. But I think one of the reasons I like the pick is that he has more of a bell cow status, at least he did with Clemson, where he had a lot of carries in a season, and the Ravens really should be seeking that behind Henry. If anything were to happen to Derrick Henry and it's Justice Hill and Rasheen Ali behind him, I don't think you have a bell cow back there. I don't think he did with Keaton Mitchell either. I thought they were going to have to get it done by committee had they lost Henry at some point, but they may well go to Adam Randall primarily if anything happens to Henry this season. I think a lot of his success is going to be based on how he learns the mesh point, how he masters that with Lamar Jackson. If he can master that, I think he's going to be very effective in terms of making the most in terms of success rate in particular out of his carries that he gets here in Baltimore. So I'm excited about him. I think a very reasonable time to pick a running back in round five. It was their last pick of that round. I'm not sure how much excitement there was over Randall, whether or not they could have gotten him even later. But given the guys they picked after him, I think they did a pretty good job. Unless you think that he would have lasted all the way to 253, which I kind of doubt. So anyway, good pick for Randall, and good job by Steve Bisciotti, if that's who the credit really belongs to. And I hope he ends up being the player that we want him to be. All right, we go to pick 211 in round six. I'm going to take a drink of water for just a second, guys. One of the problems, I like to do solo pods sometimes, but I like to do them when I don't have to talk for 2 hours straight. And one of the reasons is I just occasionally have to take a breath here. Okay, so Ryan Eckley of Michigan State, the punter, taking a pick number 211. I know very little about him, but he has the reputation as being an excellent holder. I like that. He apparently had some sort of a private workout that's been reported by Zrebeck and others that occurred prior to the draft. So the fact that that's happened makes me a lot happier. I don't know if he went through a camp with Randy Brown. Randy Brown does a lot of these kicking and punting camps and is probably the best known specialist picker out there at this point. He well could be a guy that went through one of those. He's a preseason All-American, had a great yards per attempt average. I see it as 47.7. I've also seen 48.5 quoted elsewhere. Either way, it's a great number in 2025. He was 47.6 in 2024, 46.7 in 2023. So he's been fantastic pretty much his whole college career. If you look at the highlights, the Michigan State punt coverage unit did a truly exceptional job covering his kicks inside the 5 yard line. And a lot of them are inside the 50 that they're punting from. So they didn't have any fear. They maybe, in fact, offensively used the punt as a weapon. Weaponized the punt in terms of getting these touchbacks inside the five. He had 20 in 20 kicks. He had only one touchback. So he has good touch on his kicks, getting him down in close. Now, the flip side of that is that he has a very mediocre hang time for a draftable punter at 4.07. So he may have some history of directional kicks, and I didn't look at all his punts. I looked at his highlights, and he had, you know, some nice punts that were touched down inside the five. A lot of them rolled dead at that point. A lot of others, they were just made easy to be played by the coverage team, and they did a good job on them. But here's the concerning one. The yards per return last year against Michigan State was 13.5 on the punts that were returned, and over half his punts were returned. So it's not like he has the hang time to force a lot of fair catches. There were some punts down. There were, you know, a couple of punts went out of bounds and whatnot, but he didn't force a lot of fair catches this last year. And they did have a very good yards per return on those more than half of the punts that were returned. So that would be the major concern. Clean in terms of medicals. Brown and Cook will no doubt help him polish his skills further. I'm sure they're going to keep bringing in Sam Cook until the day he tells them no, to help teach young punters how to hold, and to teach young punters some of the directional tricks that Sam Cook developed. So that'll be an interesting combination. I expect to see that at some this summer and at OTAs, maybe more specifically. It really needs to become the holder that Loop needs him to be, so that Loop can become the effective NFL kicker that I still think he will be. I don't think Loop is going to be ruined by the kick at Pittsburgh last year. I think he's going to be fine. He had a great rookie year otherwise, and should really do very well. I don't expect much of a camp battle between Eckley and Luke Elzinga, the E&E crew, this summer. I expect that to be determined pretty quickly. It may even be determined in OTAs, and they don't even carry a second punter to camp. It could be that soon that it's decided, because Elzinga was a pre-draft acquisition. The fact that they've now drafted Eckley makes Elzinga's position tenuous to say the least, as the Ravens develop needs to have additional 90-man additions, Elzinga will be a guy that they may have to let go. Now, on the other side of that, they may decide, hey, it's better to have, when you have a rookie punter, to have competition against him so that he, you know, is constantly on his toes and whatnot. Hey, that could be true too. So whatever psychology is going into this, it's above my pay grade, and they'll I'm sure they'll figure that out. Let's move on. We're going to round seven, pick 250. Now, we're really down into Mr. Irrelevant land. Last pick was 257 this last year, but there were several names on the board, particularly on the defensive line, which is very unusual that there'd be guys this late who would still be available that you know, the panelists are high on, that were high on my board. But one of them was there, or several of them were there actually, but Rashawn Benny was the guy they picked at number 250. I had a four for par, fifth for value round on him. So a guy I had much higher in the draft. I think the other people might have even had him higher than say 115 as a guy interested in taking. The Ravens get it at 250. So 6'3", 298, 33 3/8-inch arms, ran 490, but that was an other measurement. So I guess we do have to look at that as a jaundiced eye. Quickness is not his big thing as an interior defender. Did have a very poor shuttle and a poor three cone. And he turns 24 in May. So you may consider him. I'm not sure how DaCosta was exactly calibrating his age group when he said that 18% of the players were 24 and older this year. But Benny, he may include that group because it may be at the start of the regular season as opposed to at the draft. If it was at the draft, then he's clear. He's still 23 at the time of that. Now, stops to miss tackles is where he is exceptionally good. Last year, a 4.0-1 ratio, which is just average for a defensive lineman. Career 11.4-1. In fact, he's got only a 4.6% missed tackle rate. So prior to 2026, just an outstanding number of stops relative to missed tackles. Has played 58% pass snaps in his career. His body type is the one that you would expect to be compete with Aeneas Peebles for playing time as a penetrating three tech on passing downs. And that's where I would expect him to fit in for the Ravens. In fact, it's one of the good camp battles that's setting up is which one of these guys is going to make the team. Peebles had a lot of trouble getting on the field. He's a little shorter, a little less long as well, which means he's going to have trouble against the run. And he's a guy who was primarily in there for passing downs when he did play and had a lot of trouble getting activations. So I think Rashawn Benny would be my early preseason favorite to win that job away from Peebles. And Peebles may be a guy that they even are able to keep on the practice squad. I don't know how that'll work. Rashawn Benny does have some medicals, a knee injury from a high school car accident, a broken fibula versus Alabama in the 2023 Rose Bowl. Hopefully both of those are in the past and far enough that it doesn't matter. He spent a lot of time playing the last couple of years behind Mason Graham and Kenneth Grant anyway. So the two obviously very highly drafted linemen from Michigan the last two seasons. So he wasn't in a position to get a ton of playing time behind those guys. He's played primarily pass snaps in college. He did provide only minimal pass rush value for a draftable inside IDL in college, but he's got a little something. I'll get to some of that in a little bit. He had made 49 of 50 tackles in his first four seasons at Ann Arbor. He missed four in 2025. So that's where he jumped from that 4.0 stops to miss tackle rate to 11.4 career. That's the primary reason. It's still an absurd stops to miss tackle ratio. One thing that's nice about him is he knows how to get his hands up. He's not super tall, but he does have pretty good length. And he knocked down six passes at the line of scrimmage in 699 career pass rush snaps. There's a lot of guys in this draft, including some guys who are much taller, who've had a lot of trouble getting their hands up. They've got Brent Urban-esque size, and they're not getting their hands up and knocking passes down. So that's just the way it goes sometimes. And he's had a few. If you look at him, he plays in a 4-point stance and fires out of that. Really puts himself in a place to shed that block at first contact, and that's what he's looking to do. I describe him as a shed then chase player, and I could tell you the difference. You probably heard it before in this show: shed then chase versus bull then shed. So, a shed then chase player is looking to might be called a penetrator, but he's looking to win oftentimes on a half man, but definitely by shedding that man at first contact, as opposed to bullying that player with both arms and essentially two gapping, run or pass. This could be run or pass, and then effectively shedding that player later when he can make a play, and using that two hands on the opponent to control space during the interval. Anyway, Benny is much more in the former class, where he's a shed then close player. So he wants to get rid of the block opposite, and then he wants to run down the running back, the quarterback, whoever he's looking to get. And you see that very consistently in what he tries to do. Big lateral pursuit player. That's one of his strengths. He has a very good closing burst. Almost looks like an edge defender when he does that. He definitely some edges just have outrageous closes, and then they use their length very well to finish. Benny has some of that, and hopefully, at least versus the run, we'll see some of that. Now, he is an older player. He had his best seasons at age 22.5 and 23.5. That said, he's always been a great tackler, and he's used his quick and violent hands to shed blocks effectively. So he'll probably start with early down snaps, I would guess. I would guess he's a guy who has to build himself up to get some pass snaps. But if he can play early downs, if he can prove in the preseason and in camp that he's a guy the Ravens can trust to play the run, that'll be a very valuable three-tech addition, because they don't really have that guy. We'd have loved another three-tech pass rusher, and there were only a couple guys who met that standard in the entire draft, Grayson Halton and, you know, a couple guys towards the top of the draft. But Rashawn Benny is one of the guys who is a little bit smaller three-tech, who gives you some ability to penetrate and hopefully some ability to be big enough on the field to play the run that we didn't really see with Aeneas Peebles. So I think that's where the competition will come. I certainly couldn't see him developing into a player who gives the team better pass rush juice in the future as well. So Rashawn Benny, anyway, number 250 in the seventh round. I think one of the Ravens' best value picks of this draft. It could really, if it works out, it's going to really work out with him. All right, moving on to the last pick. And that's Evan Bjornson of Northwestern. Now, he's had quite the long path to reach Baltimore here. He spent 5 years at South Dakota State. Sandwiched among those 5 years was a sit out in 2021, which I believe was a COVID year, but it might have been a red shirt year. And then the NCAA granted him another year to go to Northwestern after those 5 years at South Dakota State that included a red shirt season. So he's really been in college for 7 years. And he's picked at number 253, 6'4", 301, 32 and an eighth inch arms, 5'25", 40, and he's 26 years old in September. There'll be a few more jokes about his age coming throughout this. I think we'll clearly see. Measurables and athleticism are all poor, as is, of course, the age. A shoulder injury cost him one season. I mentioned he's awarded the additional season of eligibility. He was a starter for consecutive national champion FCS teams in 22 and 23 at South Dakota State. That's certainly a very nice place to start. He's played his entire career at right guard, with the exceptions of a few snaps at center in 2020. I think we're all thinking the same thing, that he immediately fits in as a player who could compete for that center role. And I'd be surprised if they didn't already think that. With that round seven pick, they're probably thinking, who's the remaining lineman who we think has the best chance to give us some value at center, maybe in 2026? They're just thinking about this year only. Then that's how you maybe get to a player like Bjornson, and you say, we don't want to take the risk of losing him as a priority UDFA, even though there's nobody going to draft him. But we'll lock him down with this pick, which doesn't really have a lot of value. They could have been thinking that. They also signed the undrafted center from Penn State, whose name is eluding me right now. So they have a couple options there. They have Danny Pinter. Reportedly, Emory Jones has taken some snaps at center. And then they have Corey Bullock, who might be the favorite to take the role. So it's an interesting collection of players, probably five below-the-line options when you look at it right there. and they're going to have to sift through and really mix up that playing time, both during practice and during the preseason, to really try and help them identify who the best player is. If I had to guess, I'd say Corey Bullock is the front runner right now, but they did give Adam Pinter some real money. Adam Pinter. I want to get his name correct. I've been saying Adam and Danny some, but it's one of those two. Anyway, Pinter, they gave some real money to. And I wonder if there might be expecting. He's very challenged in terms of size. So hopefully he's not the guy they're pushing all the chips into the pot on. They have other options at least. All right, what else to say? I would guess that Ledford liked him to become part of that. The Ravens went into this draft with 11 linemen under contract after Ioane. They hadn't picked another one until this round 7, number 253 pick. So they have 13 as of right now. They have the UDFA from Penn State. They may have signed another. I haven't looked at the UDFA listings as I was preparing for this, but they may have signed another. That would put it at 15. 15 is the typical total. Out of the 90, you typically will go into the offseason with 15 guys on your roster. And they have some ability to cut guys at the bottom of the practice squad. Penning is on the team, and he'd be a guy who was on the practice squad all last year, but he'd be probably bottom on the totem pole in terms of the chance of being cut at this point, if they had another guy they really liked that they want to play on. Jared Lichtenhan is the other guy who was on the practice squad most of last year. He has more like prototypical tackle size. I think he's probably a little safer because the Ravens didn't pick up a player who exactly matched that standpoint. So anybody they did pick up, which, you know, they probably got one as a UDFA coming, would be his competition. So anyway, last pick was Bjornsson, and an oddball pick, and obviously one that breaks all the rules for age for the Ravens to take a 26-year-old, and or guy will be 26 in September. So also, though, remember, they're using almost no draft capital on a player who's 26 years old, whereas all their top picks were 21, 22 years old as of the draft day. So that'll do it for the draft coverage. Love to get questions from you folks. Use hashtag Film Study Ravens. Hit me up with DMs on Twitter. If you have a short you want to do, I'd love to hear from you. Thanks for your continued loyalty to the podcast. I really appreciate it. Anything else you'd like to tell me about what you'd like to see differently out of Film Study? One mention that came up, by the way, on the draft was that maybe a few more live events would be good. Do I need a weekly Q&A show to just talk about a few things that are going on currently with the Ravens, have some interaction with fans that way? I'm open to it. If there's an interest in it, I'll try and carve out time for it that we make for that. And I know a lot of people locally among the creators do that. I kind of feel like it's using there's a crutch that's being used. I prefer to use the questions coming in through hashtag Film Study Mailbag so I can answer in a minute, or have two people who are answering the question potentially with opposing views on one of the offense or defense show or on with Voss on Friday Morning GM. But if you just want me to answer questions, I'm happy to do it and talk about methodology or whatever you like. And let me know in the comments if that's something you'd like to see. And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.